This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Are you checking Google News or the stock market to see if the economy has crashed yet? Even the mainstream talking heads and investment managers say it hasn't felt this ominous since the Titanic. I'm Alex Smith. This week on Radio EcoShock, we'll check in with economics and energy blogger Nicole Foss from the financial blog The Automatic Earth. Then I'll chat with co-author of The 100-Mile Diet, which became a worldwide movement. J.B. McKinnon is back with a look at what nature was, is now, and will be. We'll wrap up with another youth organizer, this time Jenna Gray Eagle from South Dakota, as she looks for a power shift. But first... That's right, boys and girls, it's time for the Fukushima Funnies. It's a barrel of laughs at Fukushima, Japan, the site of the world's first triple nuclear meltdown. The lost reactor cores were already flooded with runaway groundwater. Now the whole place is drowning as a series of tropical typhoons wash over Japan. According to the Japanese Fukushima weather station, they got 6.9 inches of rain in September, with lots more coming in October. After the leak of 400 tons of highly radioactive water in August, on Tuesday, October 1st, the operator TEPCO admitted 4 tons of contaminated rainwater spilled out during a transfer between holding tanks. The very same day, a Japanese fast food company, Yoshinoya Holdings, announced they would grow vegetables only 60 miles from the leaking nuclear plant. They're smack dab in the middle of countryside, doused with cesium and strontium from the exploding reactor buildings and fuel pool fires. That land will be radioactive for hundreds of years. Tasty food, and it's already hot. The very next day, Wednesday, more water spilled out of makeshift storage tanks with RAD readings up to 200,000 becquerels per liter. That's about 6,700 times higher than the legal limit, which is 30 becquerels. The underpaid workers, who were likely hired because they owed money to the Japanese mobsters, true story, they didn't notice the latest leak for 12 hours because, quote, it was raining. No worries. With highly radioactive water pouring into the Pacific Ocean, TEPCO had a high-tech solution. They dumped some sandbags into the drain. The contaminated water tanks are already 98% full. It's typhoon season. Each typhoon adds another 1,400 tons of water. Well, what could go wrong there? But again, no worries. Bloomberg News quotes Chief Japanese Secretary Yoshihide Suga at a press conference saying of Fukushima, "Overall, we believe things are under control." Everything is under control. This has been Fukushima Funnies with Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. You've seen the numbers. Over 48 million Americans on food stamps. One in three Italians lives with their parents. Austerity in the UK fails to halt growing debt, and Canadians are up to their eyeballs in debt. And hidden behind those government figures, unemployment is going up in many developed countries. So how long can our economic system last? That is the big question. And Nicole M. Foss has been traveling in Europe, North America, and Australia to warn us for some years. She was previously editor at the Oil Drum Canada and a research fellow at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. Nicole holds degrees in biology and law, and she blogs as Stoneley, as one of the world's top financial blogs at The Automatic Earth. Nicole Foss, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get to the global situation, tell us about your tour in the spring of 2013 to New Zealand and Australia. Are those countries in a unique situation to ride things out, or are they part of the big financial storm?
Well, they are going to be part of the big financial storm. They are lagging behind somewhat, partly because they've had a connection to China more strongly than some other places. And they've also been riding the commodity boom in very much the same way that Canada has done as well. So in all three cases, they were less touched by what happened in 2008, thanks to the commodity boom. All three of them are riding behind various places like the U.S. and Europe in terms of where they find themselves in the economic cycle. But they're all going to catch up. And I find Australia and New Zealand are very interesting because although they're near the peak of a bubble, they tend to have a sense of limits in places like that. In New Zealand, probably because it's an island, and in Australia, probably because they have a very brittle environment that is prone to kick them in the head at a moment's notice, and they simply have to deal with it. So there are fires and floods and all kinds of things that happen in a place like that. So when you tell people in Australia that there are other limits out there that they might need to be aware of, they tend to pay attention. So I find there's a lot of audience interest in places like Australia and New Zealand. I was out there for 3 months this year, and it's the second year in a row I've done that.
They're both wonderful places. I've been there, and I think they're exciting places to visit because of the culture that's going on there. I wanted to take a quick financial peek at Europe, too. Your blogging partner, Ilargi, lives in the Netherlands. That's been a powerful economy. How is Holland doing these days?
Well, Holland is slipping into recession. When I was there just a week or so ago, there were an awful lot of empty shops with two rent signs on the front. And house prices are stalling and starting to fall. There's a huge amount of personal debt in Holland. Private debt is very, very high. And so Holland is actually on the verge of something really quite unpleasant, perhaps not following quite in Greece's footsteps at this point, but the setup is very similar as it is in parts of the European periphery. That dynamic that's set up in the periphery is starting to move towards the core, and Holland will be one of the countries affected.
And you've done research in the UK. You've got lots of connections there. Are David Cameron and the Bank of England capable of preserving the British middle class?
No. The UK is one of the biggest financial accidents waiting to happen on the face of the earth because they have an incredibly high debt to GDP. And at the moment, there's this sense, if you read the media there, that, oh, the housing bubble is reigniting and it's all taking off. But what it really is a few very wealthy London boroughs are doing well because people are trying to get away from other places and buy extremely upmarket property in London. But that doesn't mean the rest of the country is doing well at all. Things are getting very difficult for much of the rest of the UK. The cost of living has been rising relentlessly, and people's ability to earn a living has been diminishing. Energy prices have been going through the roof, for instance. So it is getting more difficult on Main Street in the UK, just as it is in the US, despite the fact that you hear a lot of rousing headlines about how everything is going very well. What that means is everything's going relatively well for wealthy people at the moment. It doesn't mean that things are going well in general.
Well, I think that's true around the world. You know, there was a lot of chatter, including an article in The Economist, about Canadian real estate crashing, as the U.S. housing did in 2007. What are your thoughts about that?
Oh, I think that's inevitable. People have tremendous amounts of debt here, and house prices have risen a very long way. They have a very long way to fall. I mean, we didn't do subprime in quite the way the Americans did, but we had 40-year mortgages with nothing down. I mean, that is subprime. We tell ourselves that we were fiscally responsible with all our lending, but we really weren't. So we are also going to reap the rewards of recklessness in financial terms. And I would say most cities in Canada have quite a long way to fall. Even places like St. John's, Newfoundland, has gone up by a factor of three in the last 10 years. So even in places that have traditionally been somewhat poor, they've still seen very large rises in house prices. And whenever you have a period like that where house prices rise sharply, it's going to end up being followed by a period where they fall.
And a poster boy for these kinds of problems has to be Detroit, and you've just written about it. Tell us about that.
Well, essentially, an awful lot of cities have been doing the same thing. They've been making promises today that don't have to be kept until tomorrow. And when you do that as a politician, you get the kudos for making the promise now, and some other politician who inherits your job in the future has to find a way to pay for it. So this is a very attractive thing to do, make lots and lots and lots of long-term promises, like pensions, for instance. Unfortunately, politicians have made vastly more promises than they will ever be able to keep, particularly at the municipal level. And Detroit is an illustration of what happens when you finally hit the wall, when you simply cannot keep doing it any longer. So it's only the first of many. If people remember the analyst Meredith Whitney writing about what's going to happen to the muni bond market, she's absolutely right. She was a little bit premature, but she's absolutely right about her description of a whole range of municipalities in the states about to hit that wall. Not immediately, but over the next few years, there will be many more Detroits. And in fact, it'll happen at the state level as well. And states and municipalities can't monetize debt and they can't print money. So whatever the feds do, it's not going to stop the states and municipalities from hitting a wall. In Detroit, the pensions are looking at a 90% haircut. So are the general obligation bondholders. The holders of the derivative contracts, however, the interest rate swaps that I would argue Detroit was missold, they only have to take a 25% haircut because derivatives have super priority in bankruptcy. So we're going to find throughout the states and elsewhere as well, when this same dynamic hits in other places, we're going to find out what that super priority actually means. It means that the financial system that writes the rules has written itself priority when there's not enough to go round and not all promises can be kept. The promises to the financial system will be kept first before promises to retirees, bondholders, residents, or anybody else. So this is a really key point that Detroit is about to illustrate in a way that people are going to have to take notice of.
And we might even get the Cyprus-style bail-in where people lose parts of their bank accounts that were supposed to be guaranteed by the government.
Well, essentially what happened in Detroit is a Cyprus-style bail-in. The pensioners are being bailed in to bail out the banks who have sold interest rate swaps. These interest rate swaps are bets that went against the position the city had been sold. So it's not so much a debt, it's a liability because a bet went against them. But the pensioners are being bailed in to deal with that particular loss. And yes, we are going to see bank bail-ins as well. I would argue that's inevitable, very much like what happened in Cyprus. And in Cyprus, they were originally going to haircut even the deposit guarantees, the smaller accounts. They backed off on that, but only so long as the losses can be met from the larger accounts. I would argue that in many cases that won't be possible, and then we're going to see that deposit guarantees aren't worth the paper they're written on. So it's certainly not going to be a one-off what happened in Cyprus. The U.S., the U.K., Canada, and New Zealand, and Australia all have legislation either in place or coming that will provide for exactly that mechanism. And Europe has already indicated that if there are bank failures further down the line, that same model they applied in Cyprus will be used there as well. So it's essentially the whole developed world has taken this model and internalized it. So when we see bank issues, this is how it's going to be dealt with. And people really have not woken up to that fact yet.
Well, we'll get to what we might do, but you know, we all like to find the supermarkets full and our bank accounts still open. What could be done to avert the next financial collapse?
Well, there really isn't anything you can do to prevent a comeuppance when you've already run all the reckless risks. So we've had the bubble. We spent 30 years inflating a bubble, especially over the last 10, where we really threw caution to the wind and we allowed bankers to play with depositors' funds and other people's money, not just bankers, but financial institutions of all kinds. We created an enormous bubble. We created an enormous range of excess claims to underlying real wealth. And whenever you do that, there is going to be a comeuppance. So when you've got a crisis of under-collateralization, so you've got an enormous outstanding number of loans and a very small amount of collateral backing all those loans, in relatively speaking, eventually, people are going to wake up to the fact that there's nowhere near enough collateral to go around, and they're going to start asking for their share of the collateral. Then it's going to be obvious to everyone that there isn't enough to go around, and the grab starts in earnest. So we're starting to see that in places already with the asset stripping of the European periphery. We saw that with the failure of the brokerage MF Global in 2011. This is how asset grabs begin. We haven't seen it take off yet, but I would argue it will. The analogy that I use for this is to say that we're all playing musical chairs, and there's about one chair for every 100 people playing the game. While we're all up and dancing to the music, we don't notice how few chairs there are, but as soon as the music stops, the people best positioned to understand the rules of the game are going to grab a chair as soon as they can. Everyone else's claims will be out of the game. This is essentially the dynamic we've set up. This is why there's nothing you can do to prevent a financial crisis, because we've already created the excess claims. They cannot be met. Those promises cannot be kept. In other words, they will be broken. And when promises start to be broken, the value of promises disappears. Promises only have value as long as the promise itself is credible. As soon as people see that the promise to repay is no longer credible, the value of promises will collapse. There are an awful lot of promises that have basically been considered equivalent to money. We have a huge stack of IOUs that we consider to be equivalent to money, but those will lose monetary equivalence when the promise is no longer credible. So we're going to see the money supply crash, which is deflation, and this leads us into a period of economic depression that I would argue is inevitable at this point.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with blogger, speaker, finance, and energy expert Nicole Foss. Nicole, as you know, I've been covering the sky-high costs of extreme weather events, from Hurricanes Irene and Sandy, for example, to the recent unexpected floods in Calgary and Colorado. Now, I'm putting out this theory that these billions for reconstruction from climate change come with oil that costs about three times what it did when those bridges and roads and buildings were built. I think that could help break the world financial system. Would you agree or disagree?
Well, it will be an element. It's not just the cost of oil in comparison to when they were built. It's just how overstretched the institutions of government that would have to rebuild these things are today in comparison with what they were then. They're already in enormous amounts of debt, very typically. So it is much harder even to maintain infrastructure, and let alone to actually rebuild it, than it was originally. The capacity to do things like that is much reduced. So that's independent of the price of oil. Adding the extra price of oil on top of that is simply another factor. So it really is, it's a collision of various kinds of limiting factors. We're looking at reaching limits in climate terms, reaching limits in energy terms, and we're reaching limits in terms of financial capacity all at the same time, which makes dealing with any one of these aspects of crisis that much harder than it otherwise would be.
It's the perfect storm, and I'd add food to that list, too.
Oh, yes.
But, you know, central bankers, governments, major corporations, they've shown they can stall for years and maybe even decades, as we saw in Japan. Why can't it just keep going?
Japan is really not a very good example because they were the only one that went into a financial crisis when they did. Their bubble peaked in 1989. At the time, they were the world's largest creditor, so they had an enormous pile of money to burn through before they actually had to sort of deal with reality. And they were an exporting powerhouse into the heart of the largest export boom the world had ever seen. So they were able to string it out for that reason for a very long time. They are now at the other end of the cycle compared to everybody else. But other countries are not going to be in that position. Most countries are not sitting on a big pile of money. They're already in a big hole of debt. And nobody's going to be exporting their way out of this one, because when you have a collapse of the global money supply, you also collapse trade relations, goods don't move. It's going to be exceptionally difficult to import and export anything at all. So what worked in Japan, to the extent that it worked at all, is not going to work anywhere else. And even in Japan, it worked in the sense of not having them completely collapse during that period of time. But nevertheless, it didn't address the fact that they were in depression. All the stimulus that they tried, building four-lane highways from nowhere to nowhere, none of that actually addressed the issue. So they've been in a state of economic doldrums for a very, very long time. Now, Abenomics is trying to be the final stimulus, if you like, but it's really not having the effect that they were hoping, and I think it's very likely to ultimately lead to crashing their currency. So I think Japan is simply not a very good example. I think for the rest of us, it's more likely to look like Argentina. I think it's going to be something that's much more abrupt and that involves things like a very rapid systemic banking crisis, for instance. We almost got there in September 2008, and I think we're probably not going to be so lucky in avoiding it this time. I think we are going to be moving into the next phase of this crisis quite soon. Already, the Fed has admitted it can't taper. It can't stop buying the number of bonds that it buys, because the system is just dependent on this continued stimulus. And that stimulus is doing nothing for the real economy. All it's doing is blowing a series of asset bubbles, all of which are going to end extremely badly. So we've already set ourselves up for this dynamic. You can kick the can down the road for a while, but then eventually you run out of road. You get to the point where all the income streams of the productive economy can no longer service the debt that's been created. And I would argue we're either at or very near that point today.
And I'd like to get your reading on another possible aspect. We've seen major banks like J.P. Morgan admit guilt and pay fantastic fines for wrongdoing in the financial markets. It turns out even the overnight lending rate was fixed. How important do you think the problem of financial corruption in Wall Street, London, and other banking hubs is?
It's the only thing that keeps the system going at all. If you got rid of the fraud tomorrow, there would be nothing left. We're running on fumes, essentially. And in the financial context, when you're running on fumes, all you're running on is fraud, corruption, and speculation. The real economy is suffering enormously. So I think we're going to see an enormous amount of fraud revealed over the next few years. When you're in an expansion phase, people don't ask hard questions. As long as there's enough to go around, nobody asks about where it's coming from. So people just ignore what's going on under the surface, and they're mostly unaware of it. But even if they are aware of it, as long as things are going reasonably well, they don't push. However, when things move into contraction, all of a sudden, a large amount of fraud is going to be revealed, and people are going to start asking hard questions. And I think there is going to definitely be a price to pay for that, for people who've been conspicuous beneficiaries of that system.
It's just amazing how it goes. If you're down at the street level and caught with drugs, you go to jail. But major mainstream name brand banks have admitted they've been processing drug money for years, billions, maybe even trillions of it, and nobody goes to jail.
Well, they write the regulatory framework. There's been a substantial regulatory capture. Big capital writes the rules by which it is regulated. So it's really no surprise that the regulatory framework is extremely permissive. I would argue there's been a whole range of grotesque betrayals of public trust in the financial system over the last at least a decade, probably considerably longer than that. Almost all of them are legal because the regulatory framework has undergone regulatory capture. But just because they're legal doesn't mean that everyone will get away with it in perpetuity. I do think there will be a price to pay. People will start to ask the hard questions when it becomes obvious there's not enough to go around. When push comes to shove, I think there will be a price to pay, but we haven't seen it happen yet.
And here's another strange one. I know lots of people who check the major stock markets every day just to see if the system's still standing. They look at Google News to see if something terrible happened. But the stocks seem disconnected from financial reality for the rest of us. Could we fall into a depression without the stock market falling?
No. Basically, the stocks don't reflect the fundamentals. Stocks reflect people's perception. So what a high stock market is telling you is that there is irrational optimism and exuberance in the system. And we know that. We can look at the kinds of headlines that are coming out about recovery and the housing bubble taking off and everything is just going stupendously well. You look at headlines like that, that just screams irrational optimism. And when you have irrational optimism, you would expect to see the market leading into a top. Basically, that means there's nowhere to go but down. The market is a leading indicator. So you will see the market turn, and then the real economy will follow after that. And I think we're really very close to this point. If you look at the psychology of the market, the fact the insiders are selling, this is definitely the psychology of the top.
And how quickly can the international financial system collapse?
Well, it's hard to say. I don't think we're going to see a collapse overnight. However, in terms of a systemic banking crisis, that can happen extremely quickly because it's purely financial. When you have changes in a virtual system that has no actual grounding in the real world, things in that kind of system can change very quickly. So you could see a very rapid systemic banking crisis. In terms of the effects on the real economy, well, they would be very substantial, but real economy effects tend to take longer to play out. So we wouldn't get a total collapse from one day to the next, but we could see some very substantial system shocks that could play out in a relatively short space of time.
I'm Alex Smith with our guest Nicole Foss from theautomaticearth.blogspot.com.
No, not .blogspot.com anymore. It's just theautomaticearth.com these days.
Oh, my. Okay, theautomaticearth.com. Nicole, do you still have rural land in Ontario?
Yes, I do. So I'm speaking to you from a farm in Ontario at the moment.
And where will you be speaking next, and who's your guest from New Zealand?
The first talk on my next tour is in Haliburton on this coming Saturday. And then I'm going to be driving down to meet my co-presenter for the rest of the tour in Los Angeles. We'll be going up the West Coast, all the way from Los Angeles up to Powell River, British Columbia, visiting various places along the way. Then we're going to be going across the country, down through Idaho and Utah, up to Wisconsin and Michigan, down through Ohio, down the East Coast, back up again to New York over about 6 weeks. So we're going to do of the order of 20 engagements during that time throughout the United States and on the West Coast of Canada.
And that's with Lawrence.
Yes, this is with Lawrence Bomert from New Zealand. So he specializes in community initiatives and transition, alternative trading relationships. So we're going to be doing this tour jointly this time. So this is a first for me, doing a tour, an entire tour with another speaker. But I think people will find that our material fits very well together.
Well, you've just named a lot of places where Radio EcoShock is broadcast, but what if people aren't going to be part of that tour? How can they see some of your speeches?
Well, we've just finished filming another set of our material. So we filmed our joint material, and that is going to be available in the not-too-distant future. So the material that we're presenting on our tour will be available for people to purchase if they choose to do so. And we also have our other material that we prepared earlier that we already sell on the Automatic Earth. There's not going to be a complete overlap. So the older DVD covers issues to do with energy and preparation that we're not covering in the new one. The new set covers a different kind of material. It's a financial update, but it's also then Lawrence's material on community capacity and redeveloping civic leadership. And we also have a presentation aimed at local government, looking at the specific challenges and potential solutions that local government are going to have to address over the next few years. So both sets of DVDs are relevant.
And is there anything else you would like to talk to our listeners about?
I would really like to stress that people think that things are all right, that we can kick the can down the road eternally, and that we don't actually have to actually do something. And I think we really do. People say, well, if we don't know the time frame, we want to wait and see till something happens before we take action. I would say you simply can't afford to do that. If you wait until you really see things start to happen in the real world, it will be too late to undertake most of the preparative efforts that you might have been able to undertake had you done so sooner. So I think time is of the essence. There's not an awful lot of time. If people want to inform themselves and do something about what's coming, now would absolutely be the time to do that.
So build your community, try and straighten things out, get your food production going, and learn from Nicole Foss. She is a blogger at theautomaticearth.com and financialsense.com. Nicole has been traveling around the world lecturing about energy, the environment, and the looming economic crisis. As always, Nicole, I appreciate getting more truth than those corporate cheerleaders offer us. Thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith. Find more links for this interview in our show blog at ecoshock.info. I'll be right back with J.B. McKinnon and Jenna Gray Eagle.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.